The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
The perfect business gift is simple to give and a joy to get. That's exactly what Omaha Steaks business gifts deliver. Omaha Steaks offers a huge variety, from premium steaks to skillet meals. They also offer flexible gift plans for big and small businesses. Order the perfect business gift to try the Omaha Steaks gift experience for yourself, or send it as a gift. The perfect business gift includes 4 5-ounce bacon-wrapped tri-tip steaks, 4 4-ounce Omaha Steaks burgers, 4 3-ounce gourmet franks, 2 4-ounce boneless pork chops, 4 3-ounce kielbasa sausages. Plus, you'll get free shipping and 4 free caramel apple tartlets. This exclusive package is only $59.99. So go to omahasteaks.com, type Nation in the search bar, and choose the perfect business gift. Again, visit omahasteaks.com and enter code Nation in the search bar to send or experience this exclusive gift package for only $59.99.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup, picking up the pieces Harvey left behind.
What's next in this long road to recovery?
Gas prices on the rise.
The petrochemical refining industry is going to be shut down for some period of time.
And more original reporting on the bizarre attacks injuring diplomats in Cuba.
Sounds that we can't hear can damage hearing too.
I'm Steve Dorsey at the CBS News Washington Bureau. Let's start this weekend with CBS News correspondent Steve Futterman, who's been doing tireless reporting on Harvey for more than a week. Steve, thanks for taking a moment to talk with us.
Great to be with you, Steve.
Steve, you're in Houston now. What does the recovery and cleanup look like there?
Well, in these areas that were very hard hit, where the flooding took place in these large sections, many of them neighborhoods, some of the floodwaters remain. In some areas, there's still very deep floodwater. And in those areas, there's no real recovery process underway yet. But there are other areas that already the water has receded, and some people are already rebuilding on some front lawns in these areas where the water has receded. You see masses of what is now junk, things that were part of their homes which have been ruined by the waters, and now they just have them on their front lawn waiting for it to be hauled away.
We heard an estimate of 100,000 homes in Houston and in parts of Texas damaged by Harvey. Is it surreal to go through these neighborhoods and see just how severe the damage is?
Well, for me, what's surreal is just realizing what these areas were at one time. For me, the surreal aspect is going to these areas where neighborhoods have become lakes and rivers. It just, again, gives you an idea of the power of Mother Nature when things like this occur.
How long do you think it's going to take for Texas and even Louisiana to recover? How much work is still ahead for folks in those areas?
Technically, it's going to take years. I think most of the general recovery will probably take months. Once the water recedes, these neighborhoods will at least look like neighborhoods again. And then you have to discover how many of these homes are salvageable. In other words, how many of these homes can be rebuilt? Remember, the water can really seep into these foundations, these walls. And sometimes, and in many of these cases, some of these homes will have to be completely destroyed and rebuilt.
What about the people affected by this storm? Thousands are still in shelters. What struck you about the people that have been struggling to cope?
One thing that was just very touching, and I think all of us who cover this realize that just the emotions when people were rescued from their homes, just the joy on their faces when they got to the point where they could step on dry land and knew that they were about to be taken either by a friend or a relative or by some local government agency to an evacuation shelter. There was just relief on their faces, and quite often these were large families, and when I would talk to the parents repeatedly, they would say, I just didn't want my kids to be harmed. I sometimes saw young children with their animals. They brought their animals with them. One young girl who was 13 had this beautiful young German shepherd, I remember. The other thing that for me just is just remarkable is how we had so many ordinary people, volunteers, who on their own just showed up. They were not recruited. At some point they were asked for, but they even were showing up before they were asked for with their own boats, with high water vehicles if they had them, with jet skis. Anything they could do to help people escape these dangerous situations, they were willing to volunteer, show up. And listen, they played a very key role in all this. There were not enough fire department seaworthy vehicles or police department seaworthy vehicles to make all these rescues. You did really need the private sector, the regular ordinary people to help in this effort, because thousands of rescues took place.
CBS News correspondent Steve Futterman in Houston. Stay safe, Steve, and thanks for everything.
Thanks, Steve.
Rick Perry is Secretary of Energy. He was also the governor of Texas for nearly 15 years. Thanks for talking to us, Secretary Perry.
Honor to be with you. Thank you.
First, what's your reaction to what you've seen been going on in your home state?
Well, it's obviously a different storm than we've ever seen before. Over that period of time I was governor, we had a lot of different natural disasters, everything from man-made disasters like space shuttle disintegrating over East Texas, to the Queen Isabella Causeway being struck by a barge, to a number of very large hurricanes, the result of Hurricane Katrina over into Texas, all caused different impacts on the state. This storm is different. This is historic flooding. This can be a very long, arduous, and costly recovery. But with that said, the people of Texas are a resilient lot. Our faith-based community will be very actively engaged in housing and taking care of the people who have lost all of their physical belongings. And the state, Governor Abbott's doing a very good job of managing this, and his emergency management team there in Austin, Texas, they're being supported by the federal government. And that's the structure, and that's the way it's set up. It should be. This is not the federal government show to run. This is the state of Texas with the auxiliary support of the federal government.
How has Houston's energy industry been affected by this?
Well, you have the largest petrochemical manufacturing production, refining capability in the country along that Gulf Coast. Now, it's not just in the Houston area, but obviously the Houston Ship Channel, one of the larger ship channels and ports in the world. The petrochemical refining industry is going to be shut down for some period of time. It will have an effect on gasoline, gasoline prices, of course. It have an inverse effect on crude prices. So, because the crude has no place to go to be refined. I mean, it's just this is a triple whammy when it comes to the economy of Texas at this particular point in time. It's big refining production and value-added part of the world that's been impacted by this storm. The refining capacity, it will take them some time to get back online again. I don't want to be trying to look into the future here, because this is such a different event than we've ever had before. But the good news is, you know, this state will be back. It will be back strong. Its people are resilient. We've had these storms before throughout history, and although it's difficult, there are, you know, lives that have been lost, and those are not replaceable. But property is, and we'll manage through all of that.
Secretary of Energy Rick Perry, thanks for talking with us.
You're welcome. God bless.
Still to come, the role of social media in Harvey.
I think it really brought home in one more way the enormity of this issue.
That's next on the Weekend Roundup. On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. One of the places where Harvey has had the biggest impact is on social media. You've likely seen that picture of several elderly women sitting in several feet of water at a nursing home, or that fake image of a shark swimming down a highway. Let's talk now with CBS News technology consultant Larry Magid about this. Hi, Larry.
Hey, Steve. Well, you know, that elderly picture of the elderly people in the wheelchairs, first of all, help did come. And second of all, I think it really brought home in one more way the enormity of this issue when you see very vulnerable people literally sitting in up to their chests in water. And social media heavily circulated those images, and I think it really got people thinking even deeper about the nature of this tragedy.
What do you think people were thinking about
Well, I just think the fact that when you see something on your Facebook feed, I don't know why, it's not that it's any stronger than seeing it on television, but maybe it comes home a little more, just this notion that you're getting this image, perhaps sent by or forwarded by a friend of yours, that just tells you, oh my gosh, this could be my parent or grandparent, or I could be one of these people who's being plucked from a stream. I just think it just takes a more personal level. And of course, the other thing that really struck me about social media and the storm was the way people were using social media in lieu of 911 when they couldn't get through to those incredibly crowded 911 service centers. They were going on social media to say, hey, we need help, or we know someone who needs help. And indeed, there were first responders who were monitoring those channels, so to speak, those profiles or Twitter handles or hashtags, and went ahead and sent help. So that's something we hadn't heard before, where social media literally being used as an alternative to an overly beleaguered 911 system.
And on the flip side of that, we saw emergency officials tweeting out statements to either evacuate or find an mm-hmm. area you can escape these floods, trying to talk to them as power is out for televisions and other types of communication devices.
Yeah, and of course, we've seen officials use social media before to warn of impending disasters or give advice. But what also happened was really fascinating to me is that the sheriff of Harris County, where Houston is located, actually used, I think it was Twitter, to call for help because there was a pregnant woman who needed to be rescued, and apparently his officers and other professional first responders weren't able to get to that person, and he basically gave her address out, something you normally wouldn't do in terms of violating privacy, but in this case, it was a great idea to get her address out there and get folks to help her. So that's unusual to see professional police officers and firefighters ask the public to go in there and pitch in. But this was an extraordinary situation.
What about the low points?
Well, you mentioned the shark swimming, the fake news. Also, I haven't seen it happen yet, but I'm sure it will, is people using social media to try to raise money for fake charities. I urge people to really be absolutely certain if they're giving online that they're going directly to the URL of the charity that they want to give to and they vetted that charity. So we're going to see a lot of fake information, and I've seen some divisive comments. For example, people responding to some of the political machinations around Harvey in ways that are kind of divisive and mean, that may not be so helpful. So yeah, you're always going to have the downside, but I think this is an area where social media has shined. It has literally helped save lives, and I think we can mostly celebrate the good news that social media has come of age and really has helped out in this situation.
Larry, I want to play a clip from this app called Zello that acts as a walkie-talkie of sorts that apparently some first responders have been using in Houston.
I have somebody that I need rescue ASAP. It's a pregnant woman and a child and an elderly person. I need help at 1-2-4-3.
So, Larry, how has mobile technology been used differently in Harvey?
Well, you know, Zello, they call it a walkie-talkie, but it's really more like a CB radio where people can get into channels and can call for help or say, we're going to respond to help. And in that particular case, help did come. I was monitoring that channel and somebody came on shortly thereafter and said, we're on our way. So this is an example where you can basically supplement existing technology. Sometimes ham radios come to the rescue. Sometimes cellular apps come to the rescue. It's important that we have redundancy. And the Cajun Navy, that group of small boat owners who have come to the rescue in this and other water disasters, are using Zello as essentially their communication center. You don't need an expensive set of transmitters. All you need is a mobile phone and access to this free app.
CBS News technology consultant Larry Magid, good talking to you again, Larry.
Thanks so much, Steve.
There's new hope now for kids suffering from leukemia after the FDA approved a breakthrough treatment. Here's correspondent Jim Axelrod.
After battling leukemia for years, Mitchell Carbon got devastating news. The cancer had spread to his brain.
3 years of fighting, all the sacrifices I made, it just seemed like it was all wasted.
But hope for the now 19-year-old came in the form of a trial run by Dr. Stephen Grupp at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia.
This is a brand new way to treat cancer.
In the trial, a patient's T cells, or white blood cells that fight infections, were removed, shipped to a lab, and genetically modified to recognize cancer cells. Those new T cells were then put back in the body, ready to search out and destroy the cancer.
These are patients who have no prospect for long-term disease control, who get a single infusion of the cells, and many of them remain in remission.
After just one infusion 2 years ago, Carbon is now cancer-free, part of a trial group that saw an 83% remission rate.
Just the fact that I even get a future is just completely remarkable. I shouldn't be alive right now.
So far, the FDA has approved this treatment only for this one type of childhood leukemia, but approval for battling lymphoma or cancer of the lymph nodes could be next. Jim Axelrod, CBS News, New York.
A judge has thrown out involuntary manslaughter and felony aggravated assault counts against members of a Penn State fraternity charged in the alcohol hazing-related death of pledge Timothy Piazza. The judge dismissed charges altogether against four of the members of the now shuttered Beta Theta Pi fraternity. Defense attorney Theodore Simon.
This court has dismissed those charges, and has done it in a resounding way. It has absolutely, legally, and factually eviscerated the Commonwealth's claims as to those charges.
The judge ordered 12 of the defendants to stand trial on lesser counts. CBS News legal analyst Ricky Kleeman.
The Piazza family, which has been really steadfast as well as vocal, must be devastated.
The U.S. is shutting down several buildings used by the Russian government in this country. White House correspondent Stephen Portnoy explains.
The State Department says this latest move achieves parity between the U.S. and Russia. After Saturday, each country will have three consulates. But in Moscow, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov called it an escalation of tensions. The U.S. is giving Russia 48 hours to close its consulate in San Francisco and annexes in New York and Washington. Last month, Moscow kicked out hundreds of Americans. That was a delayed response to Barack Obama's punishment for Russian election meddling.
Up next, the medicine and science behind the bizarre injuries suffered by diplomats in Cuba.
We are still learning a lot about the basic mechanisms by which this happens.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your jobs to find the best candidates? With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to 100-plus job sites with just one click. Then, their powerful technology efficiently matches the right people to your job better than anyone else. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them. In fact, 80% of employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate through the site within one day. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, our listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/FTN. That's ZipRecruiter.com/FTN. One more time to try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/FTN. That's ZipRecruiter.com/FTN. ZipRecruiter.com/FTN.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. We've learned some new details about a story CBS News first broke about American and Canadian diplomats in Havana suffering hearing loss and even brain damage after being exposed to what's thought to have been a sonic device. The Union for American Diplomats says they also suffered symptoms including cognitive disruption and brain swelling. The latest assessment of the attacks by intelligence analysts points to inaudible, ultra, and infrasonic waves, according to a source familiar with the incidents. The source says analysts, however, are still working to rule out other causes for the symptoms. I talk with Georgetown University Hospital ear surgeon Dr. Michael Ho about how these waves can affect the tiny hairs and cells inside your ears that help your body interpret sounds.
Sounds that we can't hear, both ultrasonic, so above our hearing range and below our hearing range, can damage hearing too. And it's likely that it's not just the hair cells that can be damaged in it's other cells in the ear that help with hearing that can be damaged. But we know that sound that is below the range at which we hear, so the infrasonic sound, can travel at longer distances. We know that sounds above our ability to hear don't travel as far, but can nonetheless contribute in the appropriate setting to hearing loss.
How much still do we don't know about this field?
You know, surprisingly, there's there's probably a lot, and there's a very active field in looking at the death of hair cells or the loss of hearing as it relates to noise. And I think we are still learning a lot about the basic mechanisms by which this happens. And I think when it comes to infrasonic and supersonic sound, I think we're definitely still kind of at the forefront, meaning we don't understand a whole lot.
How much of an effect does sound have on other parts of your body? For instance, your blood pressure or your, I don't know, balance?
So your balance is part of your ear too, but balance is also part of balance is not just the input from your ears, it's the input from your eyes, your muscle and joints, your spine, and the brain, kind of bringing all that together, and the centers in the brain that are responsible for balance. So balance is complicated, as you've alluded to, and I can't necessarily comment on kind of other parts of the body like blood pressure, but we do know that people who have been exposed to loud sounds or that are, take for instance, people who have been exposed to blasts, which are acoustic in part, they can experience symptoms other than are related to hearing or balance, and they can experience symptoms that are akin to a traumatic injury, or traumatic brain injury. So I think sound has an effect in other parts of the body. I don't think it's as well studied as we would like.
That's Georgetown University Hospital ear surgeon Dr. Michael Ho. Meanwhile, CBS News has learned the identities of the two Cuban embassy officials the U.S. expelled May 23rd as Frank Silva Hernandez and Joel Lago Oliva. A source describes them as intelligence officers. And Russia is pushing back against suggestions it may have been involved in the attacks to drive a wedge between the U.S. and Cuba following what were improving relations. Here's Foreign Ministry spokesperson Maria Zakharova through an interpreter.
We are ready to help the Cuban side to investigate the matter and point out that this is yet another absurd development in this information campaign aimed at forming the public opinion.
Cuba has denied any involvement in the attacks or that it would have allowed them. U.S. bombers and fighter jets took part in a joint live-fire drill in South Korea on Thursday, intended as a show of force against the North after its latest missile launch last Monday.
Kim Jong-un rose before dawn to oversee preparations for the launch. An intermediate-range missile that for the first time overflew Japan and landed in the Pacific 1,700 miles away. He seemed more than a little pleased with the result, which the North Korean news agency said was a drill for an attack that would shut down the American airbase on Guam. President Trump, who just last week said Kim was starting to show a little respect for the U.S., responded angrily. "Talking is not the answer," he tweeted, seeming to rule out the possibility that negotiations could end the building crisis with North Korea. But just a few hours later, the Secretary of Defense, meeting with his South Korean counterpart, sounded less belligerent.
We're never out of diplomatic solutions. We continue to work together, and the minister and I share a responsibility to provide for the protection of our nations, our populations, and our interests.
That protection depends in part on ballistic missile defenses that could shoot down incoming North Korean missiles.
David Martin reporting from the Pentagon. Meanwhile, the U.S. is publicly accounting for more troops in Afghanistan than it had acknowledged were there.
The Pentagon had previously only acknowledged 8,400 troops in Afghanistan. Now,
we're saying the number is 11,000 today, and we're going to go up or down slightly based on the operational requirements.
General Kenneth McKenzie, the number now includes temporarily deployed forces. Defense Secretary James Mattis wanted more transparency.
It actually lets the American people know what their sons and daughters are doing in Afghanistan, how many are there, and I think that's a reasonable thing.
The new accounting comes as the U.S. considers sending more troops to Afghanistan. Cammy McCormick, CBS News, The Pentagon.
On Thursday, the British royal family marked the 20th anniversary of the death of Princess Diana.
The gates of Kensington Palace are covered with photos of the late Princess Diana. People here in London say 20 years later, the princess is not forgotten.
She was such a beautiful person that, you know, it's a memory that everybody wants to keep.
On the eve of the anniversary, Princes William and Harry brought flowers and thanked well-wishers who came to remember their mother. Princess Diana was one of the most famous women in the world, thrust into the spotlight at just 19 when she got engaged to Britain's Prince Charles. Over the next 17 years, she became the most photographed woman. And some, including her sons, believe the paparazzi, who hounded her in Paris the night of the car crash, are partly to blame for her death.
The people that chased her into the tunnel were the same people that were taking photographs of her while she was still dying on the back seat of the car.
Royal biographer Ingrid Seward says two decades after Diana's death, it's much harder for the press to gain access to the monarchy.
Well, they loathe the media, and they loathe us all, I can assure you. And there's no such thing as friends within the media.
London is filled with memorials to Princess Diana. Perry Trethaway from New York City visited one of them. She was in fourth grade when she learned Diana had died.
When I think of her, I see her with, you know, the little boys, William and Harry, and I just remember thinking she was such a lovely mother.
Princess Diana was 36 years old. Terry Okita, CBS News, London.
Coming up on the Weekend Roundup, StoryCorps on the purpose and passion of work this Labor Day weekend.
Makes me feel it's worthwhile what I'm doing, that I'm doing a good thing.
Follow us on Twitter. We've got headlines at CBS News Radio, and I'm tweeting at Steve_Dorsey on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. This Labor Day weekend, we've got more from StoryCorps. You may have already heard some of the group's work before, where two people who know each other record a conversation that's archived at the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress. For Labor Day, StoryCorps combed its archive for stories on the purpose and passion of work. Our first story comes from 86-year-old Herman Hine. More from our own Jill Schlesinger.
On just about any clear night, you can find Herman setting up his telescope in Fells Point on the Baltimore waterfront, where he invites anyone and everyone to have a look at the stars.
Uncle Herman, what did you think you were going to be when you grew up?
I wanted to be a scientist, but I have certain kinds of learning disabilities. My mother used to say, you can spell Andromeda, but you can't spell anything they want you to do in school. I don't know, some people like trees, some people like birds. For me, it was stars.
How long have you been doing street corner astronomy?
I just finished my 27th year. I've been out on the street 2,637 times. I had been working for, quote unquote, the man for many, many years, unsuccessfully. Each time I'd start a new job, I'd say, I'm going to stay with it, get benefits, get retirement. But 3 years later, I couldn't stand it anymore. I had to get out of there and got another job. And Friday night, November 13th, 1987, it was a really beautiful evening. The moon was up, and I decided, heck, I'm going to take my telescope on the street and invite people to look at the moon and Jupiter. And as I was walking out the door, I said, I'll take a hat with me and see what happens. That first night, I made $10. And I went back the next night and made $40, and that's how it started. Back in 1997, a local writer wrote about my being a star hustler on the street. One of the questions was, how did you get started in astronomy? And I said, Miss Wicker's class in the eighth grade, she drew the Big Dipper on the blackboard, said, go find it. I didn't know if Miss Wicker was dead or alive, but she saw the article and called me up. And I was one of the eulogizers at her funeral.
How would you like to be remembered?
I don't want to be remembered. Halley's Comet comes back in 2061, and I want to be around. But I can name people who have looked through my telescope and taken up astronomy themselves, bought their own telescopes. Somebody else said they named a boat Saturn after looking at it through my telescope. Makes me feel it's worthwhile what I'm doing, that I'm doing a good thing. And over the years, I've been hoping that somebody would come along and say, I got my PhD in astronomy, having first looked through your telescope, but it hasn't happened yet. I'm hoping it still may.
That's Herman Hine with his nephew, John, in Baltimore.
This next story begins in the Jim Crow South, where Wendell Scott began his career as a NASCAR driver. He died in 1990, but one of his sons, Frank, and his son, Warwick, came to StoryCorps to remember him.
He started racing in 1952, and, you know, it was like Picasso, like a great artist doing his work. And he was in that car, and he was doing his work. And as children, We didn't have that leisure time. You know, we couldn't go to the playground. He said to us, I need you at the garage. I can remember him getting injured, and he'd just take axle grease and put it in the cut and keep working. But he wasn't allowed to race at certain speedways. He had death threats not to come to Atlanta. And they had to say, look, if I leave in a pine box, that's what I got to do, but I'm going to race. I can remember him racing in Jacksonville, and he beat them all. But they wouldn't drop the checkered flag. And then when they did drop the checkered flag, they had my father in third place. One of the main reasons they gave was there was a white beauty queen, and they always kissed the driver.
Did he ever consider not racing anymore?
Never. That was one of my daddy's saying. When it's too tough, everybody else is just right for me. Like I can remember one time when we were racing Atlanta 500, and he was sick. He needed an operation. And I said, Daddy, we don't have to race today. He whispered to me and said, lift my legs up and put me in the car. So I took my arms and put behind his legs, and I kind of act like I was hugging him and helping him in the car. He drove 500 miles that day.
How did his racing career officially end?
Well, finances. You know, he couldn't get the support where other drivers that we were competing against had major sponsorship, providing them engineers, as many cars as they needed. He did everything that he did out of his own pocket. He always felt like someday he's going to get his big break. But for 20 years, nobody mentioned Wendell Scott. At one point, it was like he never existed. But he didn't let it drive him crazy. I think that's what made him so great. He chose to be a race car driver, and he was going to race until he couldn't race no more.
That's Frank and Warren Scott in Danville, Virginia. Wendell Scott became the first African-American inducted into the NASCAR Hall of Fame in 2015. Now to Brunell Cotland, who helped the lower Ninth Ward in New Orleans recover from Hurricane Katrina 9 years later, opening its first grocery store since the storm. Here he is with his mother, Lily.
I remember coming back home. That was the first time I cried.
We lost everything.
Yep. I was in that FEMA trailer for almost 3 years. And I drove around the Ninth Ward. We didn't have no stores, no barbershops, no laundry room.
There's nowhere for people to go buy a loaf of bread.
Right. You have to catch 3 buses to get to a store. And I was taught if there's a problem, somebody got to make a move. So I decided to open up a grocery store. I remember when I first bought that building, everybody thought that I was crazy.
When I peeped in the door before you started working, I said, this is nothing but junk. I mean, it was trash and debris on the floor that you had to crawl over. And how can he make anything out of this? But you were one of my very interesting sons. Always jump into things you had no business doing.
It was hard. It was real, real hard. And those 8-hour days turned into 14, 15 hours a day. But what motivated me the most was seeing the people that was walking by with the groceries and seeing them get off the bus with all of those bags that made me work harder. We finally did the ribbon cutting ceremony, and that day I will never forget. You served the very first snowball, and the first customer cried because she said she never thought the Lord Night World was coming back.
You saw something that I didn't see. I'm glad you took the chance.
Just seeing so many people and the look on their faces is a joy. It was a headache back then, but now it's
all worth it.
It was all worth it. And if it takes me to do it by myself, I'm going to put one business at a time back into the Lord Night Ward. Because it's home.
You can get StoryCorps stories delivered to you each week by subscribing to the StoryCorps podcast or by visiting StoryCorps.org. Coming up, more of our tribute to Labor Day on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
CBS News Radio podcasts are now on Spotify. Listen to great shows like Face the Nation, the CBS News Weekend Roundup, CBS This Morning, and more. They're all from your Spotify app on your iOS or Android device.
CBS News Radio on Spotify, the leading global music streaming service, now lets you find the right podcast for every moment. Open Spotify to listen to CBS News Radio podcasts today.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. A recent CareerBuilder.com study found that an overwhelming majority of American workers are living paycheck to paycheck.
Though the economy continues to show strong growth, it's not translated to higher wages and better benefits for many American workers. A latest retirement confidence survey from the Employee Benefit Research Institute says 6 out of 10 American workers feel very or somewhat confident about their retirement, but only 18% feel very confident.
No, not at all. I wish it was more in there.
Not at all. That's why I know I got, but I have other things I have to pay for.
I don't really have any sort of retirement plan.
3 in 10 workers report that getting ready for retirement causes them to feel mentally or emotionally stressed, but maybe even more stressful for the American worker is the future of health care. How's yours looking?
It's all right. I do. I have it through my employer as well.
I would say I do right now. I'm 25, and I'm still on my parents' health insurance plan.
But are you worried about the future of health care?
Yes and no. I'm also a single mom, so it's expensive with a high deductible plan and raising a child.
Absolutely. I'm concerned about what will happen.
Yes, I am very concerned because I know that we're dealing now with an administration that would like to keep good health care for themselves, but not necessarily for me.
And this woman says she feels almost trapped by her job because of the benefit situation.
I don't like my job now, but a big part keeping me there is, you know, I have to maintain health care.
Many of those we spoke with echoed those sentiments, saying the benefits trump job satisfaction in the chase for economic stability. Bill Rakoff, CBS News.
Correspondent Jim Crisula looks at life as an immigrant worker.
Many industries, construction, landscaping, commercial fishing, meatpacking, and agriculture, simply can't function without them. Alabama farmer Keith Smith uses hundreds of them to harvest his crops.
You want to get rid of illegal immigrants? Quit eating.
Marvin Owings is an agricultural agent in Western North Carolina.
They're here to work, not to stay here, not to live permanently. They just want to be here to work and make a living for their family.
On the Olympic Peninsula of Northwest Washington State, Steve DeMero oversees migrant workers who handpick foliage used in floral arrangements.
They're hardworking people. They provide us with a lot of product and a lot of work. I think if more people realize what they do for us, we'd do more for them.
Rick Endicott has contact with many migrants and seasonals, as they're called, in his work that's focused on the preservation of wild salmon in the Pacific Northwest.
Immigrant workers are what keep us going.
Although many of them are undocumented, Elfie Oaks has little choice but to use migrant workers to harvest vegetables on his huge farm in Florida.
We have about 4 or 5 different contract harvesters, and they go out in the morning and round up the people. The crews that I see that our harvesters are getting are almost 100% Latino.
All of the anti-immigrant rhetoric in the nation and President Trump's crackdown on immigrants have left many of them, including Southwestern Virginia's Hector Espinoso, looking over their shoulders.
Yeah, I'm scared, you know.
Once again, Rick Endicott.
The people that I know that are here, that are working, are afraid. They're scared.
That's the new reality for migrant, immigrant, and seasonal workers in the United States. Jim Crisula, CBS News, Raleigh, North Carolina.
Finding a new path after retirement.
Working.
I'm working long hours now.
When you're done putting in the hours.
Retirement.
Maybe your plans are the same as Dr. John.
I won't go fishing.
Maybe it's time to take up something new. Like the fastest growing participation sport among seniors, pickleball.
It's addictive. I try to play every day. Some things interfere with my pickleball and doesn't make me happy.
Yeah, maybe you're up for an action of a different kind.
There's no reason not to be dating just because you're later in life. So there's seniordatefinder.com, and there's a free membership that you can create a profile and email with people. Or there's seniorfriendfinder.com, and there's also datingforseniors.com.
Retirement. What was I thinking?
And maybe it's time to finally get out of town and settle in someplace like Sun City, Arizona. 7 swimming pools, 8 golf courses, 40,000 residents, all of a certain age.
You know, that's where all the old people live. And then I became one. Yeah. And it was like, this is the most natural place in the world to live.
So much to do. There's plenty on the farm.
I'll sleep when I'm dead.
That's the beauty of Sun City, boy. All your favorite activities are available to you right up the street.
Or how about affordable retirement in a 500-year-old European villa?
Find out when House Hunters International shakes up Guardia San Fromondi, Italy.
I think my front door is older than America. Yeah.
Retirement.
What you do is up to you.
I'm going fishing right now.
Jim Taylor, CBS News.
And finally this weekend, correspondent Dave Barrett takes a look at some unconventional jobs.
Some people have jobs that they just can't wait to get to in New York.
This is my current favorite.
It's delicious.
Andrea Tovar and sister Natalia say dogs deserve all-natural, gourmet, no-preservative treats.
Chicken cordon bleu, lobster roll, truffle mac and cheese.
They are dog biscuit tasters. Ever heard of a professional thrifter?
Thrifting basically means you're going to go and find secondhand clothing that's been donated, and generally you find a really good deal.
Jade Meyer finds those.
I had a fur coat that I actually found once for $4, and I think I sold it for about $1,000.
She quit her day job, now makes up to $6,000 a month. Americans chew up $3 billion worth of gum a year, but
people just spit it out wherever and whenever it loses its flavor.
That means a job for professional gum remover Anthony Mule.
This is a passion for me.
He uses steam, detergent, and a stiff brass brush to get rid of those black gummy blotches.
Actually, it vaporized.
Psst. Hey, here's Mark Hurwitz.
I'm a former CIA officer.
Now he's president of Crossroads Investigations in Miami. Think back to last year when there were Trump Tower meetings aimed at digging up dirt on Hillary Clinton. In the trade, it's called political opposition research.
People think that records are sealed or expunged, but there are ghosts out there on the internet.
And he'll search.
Everyone's got skeletons in their closet, and it's just, you know, how damaging is it going to be, and can it be found?
Do you tail people if you have to?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, databases will only get you so far.
Help NASA become a planetary protection officer.
The job is defending Earth from aliens, but they're microbes, not space invaders.
Cassie Conley's had that job, but she's moving on. When a spacecraft or astronauts return to Earth from another planet, the idea is to build some kind of biological barrier to keep those little germy things in check.
Preventing that is the whole point of this job, because we don't know.
You may need a PhD to get this gig, but it does pay six figures. Dave Barrett, CBS News.
That does it for the Weekend Roundup. Thanks for listening. We want to get your feedback. Send us your story ideas, chain letters, love letters, whatever, to Weekend Roundup at cbsnews.com. The show's always online on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, and now Spotify. The Weekend Roundup is produced at the CBS News Washington Bureau. Lou Walker is the technical supervisor. Dory Valerio is the production assistant in New York. Have a great week. I'm Steve Dorsey, CBS News.